It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Nearly 20 years ago, a federal law created a national database in which local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies can compare and share information on DNA matches from convicted felons. But courts have been at odds on just when such samples can be collected and the information distributed. The Fourth Amendment requires the government to balance legitimate law enforcement interests with the privacy rights of individuals. Joining me now in Studio A to discuss this issue is our legal contributor, University of Pittsburgh Law Professor David Harris. David, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Always good to be with you, Paul.
And if you have a comment or question for our guest, call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. This issue is bound to raise questions and things that you might be curious about. Our email address, esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at hashtag EPLive. Again, our phone number, 412-246-2002. So, David, the Supreme Court ruled this month criminal suspects can be subjected to a police DNA test after arrest, but before trial and conviction. A 5-4 majority of the court concluded that it is legitimate and upheld a state law. So, how did the High Court arrive at this conclusion?
Well, what they said was that any time you are arrested, the state of Maryland allowed for police to take a DNA swab from inside the arrested person's cheek. The big divide in these cases has been, did you have to be convicted of a crime? At which point everybody agrees your rights to privacy and so forth are greatly diminished. The state of Maryland said all you had to do is be arrested for a, quote, serious crime. And that's what the Supreme Court upheld. It said that the taking of DNA at the time of arrest was necessary to correctly identify the person being arrested, to know about their criminal background and history, and so forth. What they didn't say, the court's majority that is what they really meant, which is this is for the purpose of running the DNA sample against that database you talked about. That's what this is really about. It's about solving old and cold cases. It's not at all about identifying people upon arrest. You can do that with fingerprints and photographs just fine. So the court used a rationale, this idea of it's just about the same thing as taking fingerprints. You do these things at booking and use that to justify something completely different. But now the rule is you're arrested for a serious offense. You can be DNA swabbed at that time, even if your case is dropped, all those things. So now 28 states have laws like this. It's only a matter of time until the rest of the states do.
28 states.
Yes, that's right. 50 states say you can take DNA samples from convicted people, but this is just people who have been arrested.
And in his dissenting opinion, Justice Antonin Scalia said the majority's reasoning establishes what he calls, quote, a terrifying principle, end quote, and takes the legal concept of innocent until proven guilty and essentially turns it on its head.
Yes.
Does he have a point?
He does. Justice Scalia basically took apart piece by piece this idea that this was just for purposes of identifying somebody at arrest. It was not a very convincing rationale, and Justice Scalia sarcastically just ripped it to shreds. And basically what he says is, look, the Fourth Amendment requires more for an intrusion into a person's body. Yes, it may not be much. It's a Q-tip inside of a cheek. But still, he said, I can't imagine the founding fathers opening their mouths for that. And it's a fair point. It is a search under the Fourth Amendment, but it is a search nonetheless, and it must be regulated and handled as such. The problem that I see is that both the majority and the dissent miss the big picture. They make their points. They have very different points of view in this balance of privacy versus crime control, but they miss what's really at stake.
So 28 states and the federal government allowed genetic swabs to be taken after a felony arrest and without a warrant. By the way, what is the law in Pennsylvania? Do we have this?
We don't have it yet, as far as I know. Our police are not doing the swabbing when they arrest people. But, like I said, it's only a matter of time. And what is also only a matter of time is that this opinion will, over the next few years, other courts will allow it to apply to less and less and less serious crimes because—and there'll be slippage in what this idea of seriousness is. For instance, even in the Maryland statute that the Supreme Court passed on, it included among serious crimes and crimes of violence, it included burglary. Now, burglary is, you know, if you've been burglarized like I have, it's serious, but it wasn't the same as the others. And in Maryland, I can tell you from having practiced there, some burglaries are actually misdemeanors. So this is the way in. And pretty soon it will apply to almost any arrestable crime you can think of. That's my prediction.
Is there a different way of looking at this? Because we're approaching this, and I think it's wise to do it from a standpoint of being concerned about privacy issues and Fourth Amendment rights, there's a potential violation of the Constitution here. On the other hand, you know, even though it may be classified in some ways as a misdemeanor, if we're talking about burglary, if we're talking about people who are committing serious crimes, then why shouldn't there be a way to match them up with potentially a crime that was committed that they may be responsible for that's gone cold because of a lack of DNA evidence?
Well, you make a great point, and I would say first, it is possible to do that when they're convicted. What this law and this Supreme Court decision allowed is to have that happen when somebody is only arrested, and plenty of people who are arrested, their cases are dropped the next morning. Others are never convicted, their cases are dropped along the way, or they're acquitted. And this decision does not require that those samples, say if a person's case is dropped or they're acquitted, be destroyed. Now, Maryland's law did require that, but there's nothing in the opinion that says that has to be. So the first thing to notice is that that's a very real balancing you're engaging in, the question of privacy versus crime control. And we should own up to it is what I'm saying. What we should say, and the majority did not do this, we should say is what this is about is catching people. What this is about is testing in order to solve old crimes. Instead, they went through this sort of charade of talking about booking and arrest and so forth. So if that's what we're about and we're willing to say that you can test anybody you arrest for a serious crime, even though those people are presumed innocent, I think what Scalia is afraid of, and he's not wrong about this, is that it could apply to anybody. Why should we limit it to arrest if people who are arrested often have their cases dropped and are always presumed innocent? So the great danger here is that this starts us down the road, and pretty soon people will be saying things, well, it's only fair not that just arrested people get tested, but that everybody get tested, because we know that certain groups may be in the crosshairs for arrest more than others.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and our guest is University of Pittsburgh Law Professor David Harris. We are talking about federal law enforcement agencies comparing and sharing information on DNA matches from convicted felons. Courts have been at odds on just when such samples can be collected and in the information distributed. We'd like to hear from you, 412-246-2002. What concerns do you have about this violating your Fourth Amendment rights? Have you ever been subject to a DNA swab after being pulled over or arrested for some type of crime? And do you think that this is a legitimate means of crime prevention? And one of the things that I would ask you, David, is that should swabbing be considered the equivalent of fingerprinting? Should this simply be considered a normal crime prevention procedure? Just in the way that other evidence is gathered.
Well, we're certainly on our way to that, and the difference, and this is the sort of the heart of Justice Scalia's opinion, is that you have to intrude into a person's body. It isn't taking a photo of their face, which is visible to everybody, or a fingerprint, which is exposed to everybody, but you have to go inside their body to get it.
Now, true, but is this not like a cavity search at the airport?
Right. It's not that severe. And frankly, I think he was probably mistaken to rely on that, because it's very easy to see how, instead of doing a swab from inside the cheek, which might be the best and most convenient, you would simply have a little, like a sticky pad of some kind, and you'd say, put your finger here. And that would collect enough sample cells for you to do a perfectly good DNA test. I don't know if that technology exists, but it could do it very soon anyway. So if you can take a fingerprint, surely you can use a sticky pad to collect cells and do your DNA sample from there. So his principle, while it's a real principle, while it's something to be respected, it will not hold up under the onslaught of coming technology at all. And we'll be back to the real question, which is, what kind of a country do we want to be? What's more important to us? Is it more important to solve every crime we can? Is it more important to take DNA samples from everybody to solve every crime? Or are there going to be some limits on this?
How much concern should we have that if we're arrested for some minor offense, we could be swabbed for DNA?
I think it's coming. I don't think there's any doubt that that is coming within the next 5 years. Every state will have a law like Maryland's. A few states will push the envelope a little bit and say, well, burglary was a misdemeanor in Maryland versus King. Therefore, we're going to include misdemeanors, too, because we know people who commit misdemeanors also commit other crimes. Pretty soon, that distinction will fade away entirely. So anybody who gets arrested will be testable. The question will be, if only people arrested, well, they're presumed innocent. They often have their cases dropped. Why not everybody? And we have to decide, are we willing to put up with that? Is that the society we want? Because that will mean that nobody can say no. And I think Americans are going to have a little trouble with that. The problem is, if we don't wake up now and start asking that question and telling the Congress or our state legislatures, whoa, if that's what we think, or okay, if that's what we think, we're going to find the question decided for us before we're even awake to it.
Is it an invasion of privacy?
Well, it is, certainly, to have something taken from inside your body. But I would push back a little and I would say, there are many things that invade our privacy. It invades our privacy to have surveillance cameras in public areas. It invades our privacy to have the ShotSpotter system that can pick up noise in our neighborhoods. It invades our privacy to have GPS systems attached to the bottoms of our vehicles. But sometimes some of our institutions say that's legal. That's okay to have surveillance cameras in public areas. That doesn't invade your privacy. And sometimes our institutions, our courts, our Congress say, no, you can't just listen to everybody. No, you need a warrant to get a wiretap, those sorts of things. We need to have that conversation. Instead, what we've set up is a system where cases come to courts where the technology is way ahead of the law, and the people who should be making our policy, our people and our legislatures, are not having it.
We're talking with Pitt Law Professor David Harris about the issue of DNA swabbing. Join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. We'll take your email questions at esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. We'll continue with David Harris on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking about federal law enforcement agencies comparing and sharing information on DNA matches from convicted felons. Courts trying to decide just when those samples can be collected and the information distributed. And the Supreme Court ruled earlier this month criminal suspects can be subjected to a police DNA test after arrest, but before trial and conviction. What are your thoughts about the issue? 412-246-2002 if you'd like to join the conversation, or if you have a question about the way things are moving on this particular method for fighting crime and trying to find criminals after cases have gone cold. And our guest is Pitt Law Professor David Harris. And David, another reason cited for DNA swabbing is to help in solving these aforementioned cold cases. Do you think that this is a good tool for that?
It does. It does work. In the Maryland versus King case, the case that brought the issue to the Supreme Court, the swab that was taken from Mr. King pinpointed him as an offender in a very serious, different crime. So it does help. The question is the number of times this helped, is that worth what we will pay for it in the long run? And one of the important costs to remember is that at least now our testing and processing technology is not real fast. So we have in some states tens of thousands of rape kits, kits from actual offenses that are sitting on shelves waiting to be tested. And when we pour in thousands and thousands more samples from people arrested for whatever, we simply make the line longer. If you think about this as looking for a needle in a haystack, you just put more hay on the haystack. And so given where we are now technologically, we can only test so many of these at any one time. It's a throughput problem. That's what the engineers call this. And so that's a cost that I think a lot of people aren't thinking about. Now, in the future, undoubtedly we'll be able to test faster, sample faster, and so forth. Then the question will be, does the number of hits we're getting in the types of crimes in which we get them, is that a good enough return for the price we pay in terms of some of these other values?
412-246-2002, if you'd like to join the conversation with our guest, Pitt Law Professor David Harris. Let's go first to Greg in Churchill. Greg, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Who's going to pay for the DNA testing? Is it suspects or the government? And then I hate to see guilty people go free, but then it's going to be cost of judicial system and then imprisonment. So who's going to pay for all that?
Well, what is it? First of all, what do they cost?
They are in the hundreds of thousands of dollars when you add them all up. I mean, this is not a cheap thing to do right now. We know with anything with technology, it gets faster and cheaper as time goes on. That'll undoubtedly be true here. But the point of Greg's question is a good one. It will be borne by the public budgets, the public institutions. It's not going to be paid for by the people who get their cheek swabbed, I can tell you that. And that cost will be part of the overall question of, is this worth it? Now, if it can bring home a serial killer, if it can put together and put to bed a case of a serial rapist, I think we're all going to feel pretty good about that fact. But we have to keep in mind the whole picture. Is it, how often is it doing that? What is it costing?
Greg, thank you for that question. Let's go to Lee on the north side. Lee, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Hello, Lee.
Interesting that no one's talking about the other information that's being stored in the DNA. For example, I have no problems with DNA as identification. It's really no different from fingerprints or the facial recognition. However, it may store other information. It can be cloned. It can have diseases encoded. There could be research done on criminal genes or genes that cause certain disease or certain behaviors. And that's all being stored. So then people could do a sweep, or our government could do a sweep, to find all the people who have this new gene that's been identified with maybe criminal behavior.
I think that is an excellent, excellent question. It's worth noting that the Maryland statute that was at stake here had some safeguards in place for exactly these purposes. For instance, you were not allowed to use it to do what are called familial DNA searches, searches where you could match the DNA partially to relatives, say, of the person who had the DNA swab taken. There were other limitations in the Maryland law, too, and supposedly the samples that were taken and processed were only from pieces of DNA that would not store other information. But I think a lot of people share Lee's concern. There is a lot of information encoded in DNA. We're just awakening to that when we're told this can't possibly go wrong and it can't possibly spill over and it can't possibly become public information. I think, of the studies that just came out showing how people who'd been assured of their genetic privacy when they volunteered as test subjects in medicine were told, oh, this is private, this is never getting out, and several different teams of researchers have easily broken through and been able to identify the people just for purposes of showing it could be done. They didn't actually put the information out there. And so that gives me the willies, frankly.
And the state is saying, trust us, we won't abuse this technology, but you're saying that this stuff, these DNA samples, can be manipulated and that it's a concern.
Well, it is a concern. I get nervous whenever a government institution says, trust us. And this really gets to the heart of what I think was the missed opportunity in this case. This technology is exactly situated right in the center of what we've been talking about in the last few weeks. What have we seen? Yesterday, the FBI director confesses that the FBI is using drones for surveillance. Very limited. Don't worry. Not to worry. But they are doing it. We see massive data mining by the NSA of phone calls, website visits, videos, all kinds of stuff. We see surveillance cameras, those systems becoming more and more capable. And now we're going to have massive collection and search of DNA. What we are approaching is a point where we are going to be under surveillance often. And a lot of people are just shrugging their shoulders. It seems to me we need to have that civic conversation. And what any government agency needs is oversight, regulation, and serious enforcement when something goes wrong. And I don't yet see the inclination to do that. I think trust us is one of the most dangerous phrases that you could have.
412-246-2002 is the number to call. Let's go to Amanda in Pittsburgh. Amanda, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello?
Yes, we're here, and you are with us. Welcome to the show, and go ahead with your comment or question, Amanda.
Thank you so much for having me. I love this show. My comment to share, basically, when I was in college in Florida, like 12 years ago, I was assaulted. And 2 years after the assault, the state of Florida passed a law allowing for DNA samples to be taken for people who were arrested under suspicion of higher-level crimes. And as a result, the person that raped me actually was convicted, and the DNA that was taken from him was the key piece to put him behind bars. So in this situation, I mean, obviously, this got a very dangerous person off the street. If it wasn't for that DNA sample being taken, it never would have happened, especially 9-10 years after the case. So, I mean, I personally don't have a problem with DNA being taken when a person is arrested. I guess it's just when it's being harvested without people knowing or without there being an overarching understanding of the specifications of why it's being taken. But I feel that in this case, clearly it came to a positive result.
And we're certainly sorry that that happened to you, but it sounds like the person was found who did this to you and that it was through DNA testing. So Amanda raises a good point, and that this is the upside of the increased testing.
Absolutely, and I really thank Amanda for sharing that story with us because it really shows what's at stake here on both sides. You cannot deny the power of this technology to crack old and cold cases. It's like nothing else. So when people simply scream privacy, privacy, they've got to be more conscious of the full picture. I keep saying those words, the full picture, because of what Amanda says. And she points out very correctly that it not only got this assaulter of her what he deserved, but it prevented this person from assaulting somebody else, got him off the street. And that is good. There is no way you can argue that that's not good. The question is, how broad and how deep are we going to go? Because after all, if he wasn't arrested, the only way we would have caught him with a DNA sample is if we tested everybody. And so the question very quickly becomes, do you basically collect it from everyone, not just people who are arrested?
Let's We have just a couple minutes left in this segment, and there were a couple things I wanted to go over. And when we were talking about the government saying that nothing is shared with any other public or private party, you know, we should have our concerns about that and not necessarily be willing to trust the government 100%. I mentioned that there is also the issue of DNA samples being manipulated, and I don't want to gloss over that. Can these DNA samples be manipulated, and how concerned are you about that?
I am somewhat less concerned than some of these other things we've talked about, Paul, because as long as there are proper protocols in place for taking the sample, storing the sample, and testing the sample, it is a very reliable technology. So I don't feel that that's going to be a problem most cases. That's not going to be what we worry about the most. The question is how far are we willing to take this and at what cost?
And civil liberties groups worry that inadequate testing by overwhelmed lab technicians can lead to errors. There was one that sent a Nevada man named Dwayne Jackson to prison for armed robbery. It was 3 years before that mistake was noticed. So he's sitting in jail for 3 years because of a mistake. Then he's freed as an innocent man. So this process isn't foolproof either.
No, nothing in the system is foolproof. What that tells us is be careful what you wish for in a certain respect, because if you put tens of thousands more samples into the system, you can have a result you don't want, which is the system gets clogged, it gets overwhelmed, and testing protocols go out the window.
We'll take one last call from Chris in Castle Shannon. Chris, thanks for waiting. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, Paul and Professor Harris. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I was wondering if you would comment for me on the lack of consistency between the court's DNA ruling, in which they said you don't need a warrant, versus their April ruling, in which they claimed that you do need a warrant for blood. It just seems this is just a monumental inconsistency. And then I was wondering, if follow up on that, could you also tie this together with yesterday's ruling concerning that citizens no longer have the right to remain silent? I just view these recent decisions as evidence that this court is fickle and arbitrary and no longer a defender of civil liberties and the Bill of Rights.
Those are two great questions. I'll answer them as quickly as I can because I know we're short on time. You're making a great point. Just a few months ago in Missouri versus McNeely, the Supreme Court says you can't take a blood sample without a warrant. And so you ask yourself, well, isn't this the same as taking a blood sample? And I think the only real difference that you can point to is that you go below the skin with a needle to take a blood sample. I don't think that's much of a distinction personally, and I don't think the majority saw it as much of a distinction either. On the right to remain silent case, that is a very disturbing case. It basically says that even though all Americans have the right to remain silent, as long as the police haven't put you in custody yet, if you choose to remain silent, they can use that against you at your trial. And I think that is just wrong, wrong, wrong.
David Harris is University of Pittsburgh law professor and our legal contributor joining us in Studio A. As always, David, thank you for being with us.
A pleasure, Paul.